The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to look about health and nutrition. A lot of Americans are not getting this message because the number who are sick, I'll give you that, new and good information on juicing and what it does for you. And also, remember long ago, I was talking about how we train the members of our Natural Living and Running and Walking Club how to do the marathon. We have them visualize running it over and over again prior to actually running it. Visualization. Well, a new study came out talking about what visualization does for us in everything in life. In our social issues today, we're going to talk about debt. Are you aware that 90% of Americans experience income declines as the wealth gets sucked back into the top 0.1% of the population? We're going to tell you the truth about how much debt we're in, why we are bankrupt, why the game is up, even as the stock market is crashing down 500 points this morning, and talk about David DeGraw's new thoughts on this. Also, commentary from Naomi Klein of The Nation. The shock doctrine in practice. The connection between the nighttime robbery in the streets of England and the daytime robbery of all the elites in all the countries of the world. Why is it one is a disaster and the other is not even mentioned? So that'll be our commentary. In our environmental segment today, we're going to talk about how bad is the deforestation and why you should pay attention to it. My guest in the third part of our program today will be Robert Whitaker. He is a George Polk and National Association Screenwriters Award winner. He was head of publications to Harvard Medical School. And we're going to talk about Anatomy of an Epidemic. A hard look at the dangers of modern psychiatry and psychiatric drugs. This will be interesting because I'm filming, as we speak, a documentary called Return to the Snake Pits. For those of you who are younger, that was what they used to call psychiatric institutions, the snake pits. Well, today we're pathologizing virtually all normal behavior, so that it can be legally determined that you must be treated. And then how will they treat you if you have a made-up mental illness? I believe that all of psychiatry is a fraud. I do believe, however, that psychotherapy, as far as talk therapy, speaking with someone, has a great deal of benefit. I have yet to see a single scientific study anywhere in the scientific literature proving to me that they can make a medical diagnosis by biochemistry or CAT scans or PET scans and say you have schizophrenia, you have bipolar. There is no such objective scientific documentation anywhere in the world and never has been. It is all a fraud, complete scientific fraud. How in the world didn't you reporters at the New York Times even get this? Why weren't you ahead of this story? Well, we are. And I will nail it. A big smackdown coming to every psychiatrist in the world today. I think you're all a bunch of... And that's just the beginning of what I think of you. So I'm going to go after the psychiatrist and their stupid little pathetic excuse of a profession. Gee whiz, how dangerous you are when you try so hard to become legitimate. That's our show. Let's begin. We keep hearing how we're the healthiest nation in the world. We're not. the best nation in the world. Far from it. We are made of people who are giving and kind and thoughtful. Some are, I would agree with that. But an awful lot aren't. We have far more selfish people, self-absorbed in their own life, than we have those willing to work and help other people. But when it comes to this whole health thing, boy, did they get it wrong. Here is the latest study, and this was a very meticulous study on a lot of people. Here's what it says. 50% of all Americans have chronic disease. That's about 155 million Americans. Now, that's chronic disease. That does not include acute illnesses. And, quote, 55% of the United States said that they were diagnosed with one or more chronic conditions. Now, compare that with 41% of people in the UK. But then you start getting into other countries, they have small percentage of their people with chronic conditions. Why is that? Almost 61% of Americans believed that they were in good or excellent health, but they weren't. Now, what does all this mean? Here's what it means. That we live with adaptable illusion. What does that mean? It means that if everyone in your group is able to drink 5 beers by watching a Sunday afternoon ball game at the local bar, and no one gets down and drunk, then you consider that normal. All right? And if everyone around you is 20 pounds overweight, then that becomes the new norm. If everyone eats everything on their plate in supersized portions, that's the new norm. Don't give me a plate with this little bit of food on it. I want a lot. I want a big. I want a super big. Have you noticed the commercials? They have nowhere to go. In marketing, it's called differentiation, meaning what differentiates your product from mine. Now, if I create a product, if I invent a product, I have to try to think, how can I make mine better? Not bigger, better. So they can't make it better. I mean, how are you going to make meat from beef and then bacon and then cheese and then eggs better? There is no better. It's like, how do you make a corpse look like they're not dead? Oh, we'll put some rouge and we'll put the glasses. Doesn't he look good in the casket? No, he looks dead in the casket. We shouldn't have these open caskets. You want to see people at their best, not their worst, right? So we live with these ideas. So then when we go in to get something, we want the big bottle. We want the big iced tea. We want the big, all right? And then that's where the whole market goes. It's just like buying a car. Or buying a yacht. Or today in the paper they had that the newest penthouses, 2 penthouses in New York City, which are not even constructed yet, will cost $98 million each. Question is, and these are on 57th Street, what would allow a penthouse to cost $57 million, the most of any penthouse ever in the world? Well, it's simple. Illusion. So someone can say, I can afford this. Then the illusion, wow, they must really be something. They must be famous and rich and powerful. If you could spend $57 or $58 million on just a penthouse, and that doesn't include, then you're not going to have regular furniture in it, right? You're not going to go to our IKEA and say, what's on discount today? Can I get one of those things going to fall apart? Instead, you're going to have a designer. Now, the designer comes in. And the designer says, I'm a designer, a unique. I'm not just anyone. You want me. I'm going to get $10,000 a day for my time. Plus, I'm going to get a 20% override. Oh, I'm not going to tell you I'm going to get a 20% override, but everyone in the design industry knows this is the game that happens. is called checkbook aestheticism. You're an idiot, and you don't know how to decorate anything. You're rich, and you made your money however you made it, and I'm going to take a good portion of it, but I'm going to make you feel really important. We're going to have something designed from designer schmuck over here, and you're going to think it's better because it's costing you a lot. You can brag in the Hamptons about, you have no idea how much I just spent. We have a new toilet bowl, and they want to put gold around it because no one else had. No, Saudi Arabian prince had gold around their toilet bowl. And so ours has more gold. But because I hired this great, this you can't imagine. This person says, we're going to do gold and then platinum. So you'll have a platinum gold. And it's only going to run me, you know, $500,000. But that's for my bathroom. And someone says, well, how will anyone know? You're going to have people come into your bathroom to show you can show them that your little crapper there, that's gold and platinum lined. And then someone else might say, if they're from New York or five boroughs, they'd say, what do you need that for? You know, what, you're just going to be sitting on it. Isn't that a little over the top? And someone will say, but everything today is over the top. We can't live normal, subtle lives anymore. We can't have normal, subtle conversations. Rappers can't have anything right, right? Everything has to be over the top. I don't even expect Jay-Z and what's-his-name to come out on stage anymore. I just expect the illusion that they're there and dollars dripping from the ceiling because they're so... What are they? Wasn't one a drug dealer at one time? But we can't deal with that. Now we have the new illusion. Everything in life is an illusion today. Everything. So we have this illusion that I'm healthy. How do you know you're healthy? Well, because I'm not dead. So it's either you're dead or you're healthy, and there's no in-between. You're rich or you're bankrupt, and there's no in-between. Everything is a process in life. Everything is on a gradient, on a curve. And the further you go in anything you do, you come down off the pinnacle and you start a decline. The key is, in our world, become as successful as you can, become famous for whatever you can, become popular, become a celebrity, because then you create an illusion and you keep people saying, look at my left hand, look at my left hand, look over here, see, I had this, I live here, I did this, but don't look at my right hand because it's falling down, and all that I did, I can't anymore, and I don't anymore. But I don't want you to look at me today and what I am today. I want you to look over here. And so we say, okay, you tell us where to look and we'll look. Or hire publicists and they'll tell us where to look. Or go on Oprah and she'll tell everyone where to look. Or Dr. Phil, he'll smack in and say, look here. And we have these idiots who tell us what to think. So then the average American wakes up today and they have disease all over the body. They have inflammation because of those French fries and the hot dogs and the hamburgers and the beer. Because of watching too much television, because of being on the cell phone and being stressed and not exercising. But they don't have necessarily a disease that will kill them today, so therefore they must be ideally healthy. The study is showing, no, you're terribly sick. So let's see, in order of priority, where are we talking about health? We don't. Well, surely Americans somewhere... If you've got half of an entire nation facing disease and death, that has to be a priority, right? No, it's on no one's top 10 list of things that are important. Got our priorities straight, right? Make sure we get our priorities straight. Well, pathetic. But it's good to get these wake-up calls. So that suddenly we just have all this illusion cast aside and we see the naked truth. We are very sick, obsessed, dumbed down, selfish, self-absorbed, narcissistic, disconnected from reality society. And we're bankrupt. I'll get to that in a moment. There is good news for those of you who do care, and there are many who do care about your health and your ideas. I've suggested for a long time that juicing was important. This is the latest on juicing. from scientists Dr. David Thomas and David Marsh. They conducted extensive research that shows massive loss of minerals like selenium and magnesium and iron and copper and zinc, and from modern food technology. And the key for modern everything is convenience. And that systematically processes yet more nutrients out of our food, including processing flavor out and adding preservatives and unnatural coloring, and that also further destroy our food. And in fact, they say half the world populates burger bars and fast food outlets needs itself towards obesity and early grave. And while the media giving so much coverage and airtime to what we should be eating and often focusing on our chefs. Now, I just finished filming David Boulay, arguably America's greatest chef. He's never done a health show. He's never done any television. And I asked him why, and he says, take a look at the Food Channel. Take a look at these cooking shows. What do you see? And I said, well, a lot of very insecure men and women posturing that we should like them and make them famous to be master chefs, yet they do nothing that will enhance a person's health and well-being, and it's all about them. And he says, that's correct. He says, there's no subtlety. And the dishes they prepare, you look at them, A, the average person's not going to be able to do it, and B, they're not healthy. But they can become famous because suddenly people like them. Where you have a bunch of chefs yelling and screaming and demeaning each other and throwing knives and beating, you know, each other's egos, all so they can become a master chef in a few months. He said, in Japan, you can't become a master chef for at least 25 years. In fact, I filmed chefs that were professors of culinary arts at a restaurant downtown who are so humble because they know they have not yet had their 25 years and they're still considered learners. And yet, by any definition, they could out-prepare food of any chef in the United States. Because we want to go away for a week and come back a master Reiki grand, you know, seventh degree healer. We want to go to a health show and see some man or woman promise to heal us of everything because they are spiritually enlightened. We can't stand the idea of just doing something right. It has to be immediate, and we give too much power to the illusion of what people want us to think. So then I'm thinking, gee whiz, will the world even care about a David Boulay? And the answer is, most people won't. Because he takes his time. Everything has to be done correctly. But when you experience and see the final product, there's nothing like it. It's like watching Picasso paint. There's nothing like it. And yet, look what we have accepted now as great cooking shows. None of these are great cooking shows. They're an embarrassment to anyone who really knows food. So one of the things that has come up now is, okay, if our American diet is a disaster, and if the media is helped in the process of commercializing food to the degree that we just want a fast food meal, and we think that's a great dish, you know, let's take our friends over to Olive Garden, where you can have all the pasta you want. Let me think how good that would be for you. How much white, refined carbohydrate pasta could you put in your body before your blood sugar spikes up? And how much of those breadsticks can you eat before your blood sugar spikes up? And how much of the food could you eat before, and the desserts, before your blood sugar spikes up? Gee whiz, wonder why we have an epidemic of diabetes in America. And let's see the family all smiling as they pull through the driveway and say, give me that. And suddenly a hand whips out something real fast because you don't have to wait. But boy, it gives you that crunchy, chewy, salty, deep-fried, trans-fat, highly laden, calorie-rich, blood dripping off the bottom of the sack, ooey-gooey burger. Yum, yum, yum. Oh, what we should do is just put a camera in everyone's toilet in America and do that as a new reality show. You saw it going in, now here it is coming out. How healthy does it look now? Yeah. So juicing is certainly one way that we could improve our well-being. Juice? What's that? Well, those commie pinko gay things? I ain't trying that. I'm a real American. I want to drink cow's blood. I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. But juice is good for you. Why? Because first you're getting a concentration of enzymes, nutrients, phytonutrients, trace minerals. It's highly alkalizing. It can turn off a lot of pain in the body. And it heals. Unlike junk food, unlike the average American food, there's one commercial that's on now. It shows, Mom looks around. She's busy. What does she do? Pizza. But she adds something to the pizza. And now it's, ooh, did you make this? Smile, smile. It's a pizza. It smells like vomit. It actually looks like vomit. In fact, I'll bet if you went out on the street and paid someone to vomit on some a pizza crust, nobody would know the difference. Someone would buy it. So there we have it. Man, can we do anything right upside? Yeah, I could just see if this president had some real fresh organic juice, he'd become a constitutionalist. Easy to visualize your goal. This is good. This is from Science Daily. Quote, visualize your goal, and that's a motivator to finish your task. I remember I was going to do the World Games, and I had an injury. I just won the national championships to qualify in Hawaii, and I had pulled a muscle, and yet the World Games were only 2 weeks off. So all I did is each day I would sit for about 2 hours, and I would visualize every step of the course and my pace and time. So when I went to Spain to do it, and I focused upon every mile, and sure enough, when I'd look down, I'd be hitting exactly those seconds. And as a result, I was able to bring back a gold medal for the American team with my two running mates. If I hadn't visualized that, I'd have been visualizing my pain, feeling my pain. I would have made my pain the dominant feature of my life. Now imagine that you're poor. What are you going to visualize? Being poor and the consequences, or not allowing the conditions of your poverty to be where you're going to put your mind? Your mind never has to be poor. Your mind doesn't have to be limited, even if other circumstances in your life are. That's why it's so important to keep a positive disposition and a positive focus on what you want to achieve. And be patient with it. You've got to get out of this fast food thinking mindset that everything has to be, I have to have something now. No, you don't. Take your time. Keep your focus. Keep your focus. Discipline yourself to that positive focus. What do you want to achieve? And then that's where your mind should go. We're all going to be faced with limitations and crisis of varying degrees. It doesn't mean that we should allow those limitations and crisis to dominate our thoughts. Then we're not only poor, we're depressed. We're not only alone, we're lonely. We're not only not achieving what we want, we're in despair. It's all about where you put your mind. I'm Gary Knoll. Now let's go to our environmental section. Deforestation, something we don't hear about in the United States in the media. Here's the latest from Brasilia. Deforestation of Brazil's Amazon increased by 15% during the past 12 months, according to the National Institute for Space Research. And that they lost 1,649 square miles of vegetation in just one state. And why is that important? Because if you've ever been to Brazil, you know that it's got very little topsoil and lots of dense vegetation of trees and vines and growth, and it has a lot of humidity. Well, that humidity goes up in the air and it creates clouds which then float, and depending upon where the winds are blowing, can then cause us to go over Florida, Mexico, Texas, and then release that as rain. But if you tear down the trees and you grow soybeans, then the trees which were holding in the carbon are not there, and as a result, the carbon is released. As a result, deforestation has made Brazil one of the world's top greenhouse gas polluters, and the pace of deforestation is about 10,000 square miles a year. And as a result, Brazil is doing nothing to reduce its greenhouse gases, and China's gone in and bought all this land, rent or bought it, to feed its ever-growing affluent population by growing soybeans, which it then feeds to its livestock, so it can have more chicken, beef, and pigs. So it's a very negative cycle. And I believe that we should do a lot more to focus upon how deforestation around the world will impact weather patterns. And what we're doing, we're creating desertification. And once that starts, you're only going to have hotter weather and more drought. Our issue of the day, and then we go to our guest, and then you can call in on this. This is from David DeGraw from Alternet. He talks about, quote, the cut in taxes for the mega wealthy have led to record wealth inequality and resulted in a huge national deficit. Meanwhile, to make up for the deficit created in part by tax giveaways, a tenth of 1% of the population, Democrats and Republicans, are committed to making draconian budget cuts to vital social services which target poor, middle-class, elderly, and sick while handing out billions more in corporate welfare annually. Remember, inequality equals debt, and that equals austerity. We are the ones who are affected. That's what he was saying here. Now, here's some statistics I want to share with you. These are real statistics. What the government shares with you are not. So please listen. I am saying now on the record that America is broke. That where we would say to Greece, where they have 150% debt against gross domestic product, that means for every dollar they earn as a country, they owe to the international banking community $1.50. They will never get out of that debt, ever, unless they revolt, overthrow their government, and then cause a debt forgiveness. They just simply say, we're not paying the debt, and go off the euro, which may happen. In the United States, we say we're much better. We're at 56% debt against gross domestic product, so we're fine, which means we have plenty of money, and we can always pay our debt. And that's why no matter how bad it is in the world, everyone rushes to the dollar. Even when our treasury bills are at 0.29% interest, which means that you will actually lose money, not make any, you'll lose it if you invest in the dollar. So what's the big deal? We're safe. Well, that would be true if the figures were true. You've been lied to. Let me give you the actual figures. First, this is based upon statistics on Americans buried in financial debt. From 1990 to 2010, costs of living have increased 67%. But our wages have stagnated and declined. And as the nation's debt has increased to $14.6 trillion, that's the only figure people are paying attention to. That's not good. What about the $16.1 trillion that the Fed gave with zero interest to banks and corporations and governments around the world? Not a penny has come back. That's also debt. Until it's paid back, that is debt. So that means now that you have to add 16 onto 14, now you're $31 trillion, not 14. Then they didn't include in this 14, 6 trillion, they didn't include unfunded entitlements or underfunded entitlements. That's $56 trillion. Then they didn't include it all. How much does the average person owe in America? Personal debt, $16 trillion. You heard me right, $16 trillion. Ah, so Gary, when you were saying for the last 5 years that America is broke because Americans are spending money on houses and cars and using lines of credit, that we did the alchemy, something unique, we made debt an asset. But it's my house, it's my car. Yeah, cars depreciate. Drive it off the lot, you've just lost 30% of its value. Your house was going up with an artificial bubble, and you kept borrowing against it, and you kept them borrowing against the house, debt. So did you own the house? When you borrow against it, you don't own it. The people you took the loan from own your house. You now have to pay them back with interest. Now, they got the money to loan you at zero interest. They're giving you the house at 6% interest. Now, they're making 600% profit. So now you then went out and, oh, I want to borrow again. Value's up. So you just keep increasing the debt that you owe. But you still think you have an asset. You don't. You've exchanged your asset for money that now is a debt. Now, if you walk away, they can still say, okay, we've got your house, and according to the lease or according to the mortgage, you still owe us the money. They don't always do that, but they historically have and could. So we thought that because we were buying a lot of stuff, that we were an affluent and growing economy. Only partially correct. If you were buying things on credit, that's debt. You cannot make your debt into an asset because you have nothing to back up your debt. Your only collateral is your obligation to pay, and if not, find high interest and late payments, or your house is collateral. So then what's a plan B? You don't pay your debt, they take away your house. You pay back your debt, where are you going to get the money? Where? You'd have to sell your house in another bubble market in order to get out of debt. It's an impossible financial position that people have found themselves in, and we haven't been honest. We just keep saying, spend, spend, spend. But how are we going to make it if our costs have gone up 76%, but our wages have gone down? And yet the American public slept through this simple lesson in economics. And you can thank one of the most warped minds in the history of American economics, Thomas Friedman, for this. The Chicago School of Keynesian Logic. Such a metastasis of thought. Now, that's not all. Oh, did we forget to add in consumer debt of $2.5 trillion and credit card debt of $805 billion and student debt of $1 trillion? So let's just add all this up, and we're over $100 trillion in debt, which means that we are 200% in debt against gross domestic product. That means we are one of the most singularly, we're right up there with Japan. We're the most, one of the most singularly indebted nations in the world. Can we ever get out of it? It is impossible to get out. So obviously, the more severe your debts are, the more you have to cut back in spending, and the less money you'll have to buy new items. Hence, debt equals austerity. Meanwhile, a perfect storm circles overhead as society breaks down and falls into an economic death spiral. Healthcare, food, gas costs are skyrocketing, while income and home values are plummeting. Hence, inflation plus deflation equals stagflation. So given these conditions, it's not surprising that over 250 million Americans, the one I'm filming, just filmed them yesterday out at a tent city in New Jersey, and thank you for all the people in my audience who showed up there. I wasn't aware when I mentioned on the air I was going to be there. A whole lot of people showed up. But they had a chance to see how people are trying to survive in tents. No electricity, no water, no sewage, no food. Oh, yeah, they do have food. Every night at 12:30, a man shows up in a car, and this man has volunteered to go around to 5 pizza parlors and collect any pizza that was not sold that day and give to the pastor who helps oversee this little tent city so that their food the next day is day-old cold pizza. And that's been going on for years. Wow. So there's 250 million Americans, a record-breaking number, who are currently living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to make ends meet, and yet not a single thing is being done by the Tea Party, the Republicans, or the Democrats, or anyone else to help them. So just remember, when this blows, and it will, it's inevitable, don't be surprised. Your thoughts on this? Give us a call, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to go to Robert Whitaker, who's standing by to talk about the anatomy of an epidemic, a hard look at the dangers of modern psychiatry and psychiatric drugs, and I'll add in there the myth of these made-up mental illnesses like social anxiety disorder and math defiance disorder and parental defiance disorder and, well, just about any defiance now is now a psychiatric disease. We'll speak with him in one moment, but as always, we care about what you have to say. Gene from New Jersey, you're on.
How you doing today?
Good.
I want to ask you, how can we call ourselves the best system, which is the capitalist system, when China owns us to death?
Okay, well, first of all, we call ourselves the best system, and we say that we have the best economy, number one economy in the world. But first off, that's wrong. In fact, the European economy is larger than China's and the United States combined. All right? Get your facts straight. We are not the number one economy in the world, and we have to stop pretending that we are. Europe is. And I'll do more on Europe and why they have more small businesses. They have a better healthcare system. They do not have what we believe. We keep calling it a socialized healthcare system. That is a myth. I'll go into that in greater detail in an upcoming program. They live longer lives. And so we have to start by stop this narcissistic projecting that all things American must be the moniker of which everything else is measured. Thank you, Gene. I appreciate your call. One more from Miriam from New Jersey. You're on.
Hi, Gary. In relation to your comments about how Americans are being manipulated into buying and getting into debt, there's an article that I had read about, written by Dr. Judith Young in her Global Research magazine, and she discusses the three tactics that are being used on us. The first one is normalizing the abnormal. The second one is learning helplessness, and the third one is creating disorientation. And all of these things imposed upon the public by the media and the elite groups that need consumerism in order to further enhance their empires. And I would love to hear you comment on those.
Let's do one better. Let's invite her on the program, and I'll ask Richard Gell, our producer, to invite her on so she can discuss her thoughts.
Uh-huh.
All right? And I don't believe we have to relegate what's wrong with America to elites. We are willing participants in most of the choices we make. Do we step back and ask ourselves, what is the likely consequence of the choice I'm making? If someone's eating hot dogs and hamburgers and french fries, if someone's binge drinking in college, do they have any responsibility for their choices And then we end up with not only a sick nation, as I reported at the beginning, 50% of all Americans are chronically ill, and yet they don't take responsibility for the choices they make that get them sick. Hence, how can they take the responsibility for the choices to get them well? Our effort is not to educate more Americans about making healthier choices in anything in life. Our responsibility is to get Americans to wake up to how do they even come to their choices in life. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, 85% of everything one person says to another, if they're not in alignment, will be rejected, no matter how accurate or true or caring you are in what you're sharing with another person. If you're not in the same position, hence Democrats and Republicans will never agree, because they must reject at least 85% of what the other person says, because you're not a part of my tribe, you're not a part of my belief, you're not a part of my reality, you're not a part of my paradigm. And so this kind of isolation, separation, and exclusion of the way we live and think does not allow us to understand the larger pictures, the larger solutions, and anything that represents true healing. It's only when we become free of these beliefs can we see what we need to do and see what we have done, the best and worst of what choices we made. Thank you very much, and we will get her on the program as a guest. Thank you for sharing that with us. We're going to go over and say hello to Robert Whitaker now. I gave you his background earlier as an award-winning journalist and author of Anatomy of an Epidemic. Nice to have you with us today, Robert.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Robert, I'm going to give you three areas. I'm going to shut up and let you talk. I don't like to interrupt my guests. I like to have them do more like a classroom on the air, all right?
Okay.
First,
how long should I speak for?
However long it takes you to make your message, to give your message with context.
Okay, great.
All right, first, psychiatry has deemed itself the only legitimate, authentic science of determining mental illness, and hence how to diagnose it and how to treat it. I challenge that. I'd like your position on it.
Okay.
Secondly, the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual number 5 of psychiatry has added conditions that, when I took a careful look, literally makes almost every normal behavior now, it could be defined as a psychiatric disorder. And
okay.
But I can't find any actual science to support it. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Okay.
And third, unfortunately, people do not pay attention to the fact that study after study will show that, let's say, an anti-anxiety medication or a selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drug has effects that are not just side effects. They are the effects, and when you compare them to a placebo, you frequently see the placebo does just as well. But they're the ones who even create their own studies. There's no independent analysis of their studies, their methodologies, so we have allowed them to tell us, A, we're crazy, B, that we have to take their drugs, and C, that if our suicide and our son or daughter happened, it couldn't have been their drugs. And yet, when you watch the ads on television, they say, oh, by the way, the side effect of this drug is, and they list all these horrifying effects, and we continue to go forward as if there's no other way of approaching our problems in life. The forum is yours.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, three questions. The first is a really important one, and this is that psychiatry, the profession, has set itself up as the group, the profession that will define for us mental illness and, you know, where the boundaries are for mental illness and normalcy, so to speak. And they have also said this is, they do it within a scientific context, saying that, I mean, they allege a scientific context, saying that these are diseases like cancers or diabetes, and as if there's some really specific line between normalcy and mental illness with all their different diagnostics. Anyway, if you look at that sort of, in historical sense, where this arose, it's really in 1980 where they really put their stake in the ground, psychiatry, and say, these are medical disorders, biological disorders, and we're going to be the ones that define them. I'm talking about academic psychiatry. And that was with the publication of DSM-3, so the third version of Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And the key here is this. Before that time, if you looked at the DSM-1 and 2, there was these neurotic disorders, and neurotic disorders were really seen as, you know, we can all be neurotic, so to speak. So it's in 1980 that psychiatry says, we're putting the stake in the ground, these are these boundaries, and we're going to define normalcy and illness. Now, at the same time, so think about this. So they are setting themselves up as the medical profession that will make this determination. That's number one. Number two, at the same time, psychiatry really said, our product is drugs. That's what we sell, and that's what we're going to embrace. We'll become psychopharmacologists. Well, think of them as a trade organization that wants to have as many customers as possible, and therefore as many people as possible coming to them for drug adjustments, etc. Well, you can see they have an obvious economic incentive to define illness as broadly as possible and in every age group as possible, children's, middle-aged, adults, etc. And obviously the pharmaceutical companies will be more than happy to work with them to define mental illness as broadly as possible. So yes, you're absolutely right. Academic psychiatry set itself up as our societal group agency that will define normalcy and illness. And unfortunately, what we have really failed to understand is that has been an economic enterprise right from the beginning in 1980. And so they have had an economic incentive to define mental illness as broadly as possible. And now you hear these crazy ass things. 30%, 35%, 40% are mentally ill. Well, when you hear that, you just know it's ridiculous, and it's a meaningless term when you start talking about 30%, 35%. That's number one. And I think the other thing to understand here is there's a bit of a sham going. So there's this economic understanding right away behind this whole diagnostic thing. But there's also a sham in the sense that they're saying that we know these are biological disorders, and just like other diseases. And then you say, okay, fine. Well, what is the pathology of, say, depression? What is the pathology of bipolar disorder? What is the pathology of anxiety? And they'll say, well, we don't know the pathology. So you can see right away we've reached this sort of, a place that makes no sense. You can't really assert that something is a known disease and not being able to say what the pathology is or the evidence of the pathology. And then what they will present for saying that we know these are biological diseases is they'll run these CAT scans or brain scans, and they'll aggregate all the images, and they'll say, see, the people with kids with ADHD, their brain scans are a little different than normals. Well, what they never tell you when they do that is a couple of things. One, those are aggregate images. In other words, it's not of a single person, but it's like they've combined all the images. That's number one. Number two, what they don't tell you is many people in the, quote, normal group might have an image just like some kid in the ADHD group. In other words, it's extraordinary overlapping. Number three, they never tell you, well, are these medicated kids or unmedicated kids? Because the medication obviously changes how the brain works. Anyway, so all the brain abnormality stuff that is really used to say, hey, we know that there's something biologically wrong or different. Well, first of all, just because something is different doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong. But anyway, they say basically wrong. You have to understand even that information is so untrustworthy and open to interpretation, et cetera. So I think it's important to say, when we think about this defining of mental illness, there's an economic part to it, a big economic part to it, and there's also a sham, and they're saying as if it's an objective sense. Over here are those with some sort of abnormal brain function, and over here is abnormal, and we know these are known brain diseases. That whole story is a fraud, basically. Second, DSM-5. The only way I'm going to disagree with you here is you said, if you look in DSM-5, and this is the newest version of the manual that's being worked out now, and I think it's supposed to be out in 2013, something like that. You said that everybody is in DSM-5. Well, I actually think most everybody's in DSM-4. They've pretty much got...
Yeah, you're right. I agree.
Okay, so I mean, I'm already in there. I'm sure you're in there.
I'm in there, and I'm in there 10 times.
Yeah, exactly. So they basically, you go to a psychiatrist, and they can find something to diagnose you with. A DSM-5, one of the things that they're doing now crazy that is, the potential for harm is so extraordinary, is saying you can sort of have you can be at risk of developing a symptom, okay? You can be at risk of developing psychosis or mania or whatever, and they'll treat you at being at risk. So if you're a kid that, say, I don't know, you have a sibling that somehow gets diagnosed, now you're at risk and now you can get treated as well. So it is an expansion. So we had this first expansion where we went to 30-35%, basically just loosening boundaries. Now if we add in the at-risk categories, not only you're going to be in DSM-5, this will allow them, in my opinion, basically to diagnose almost any sign of behavior that is considered different, troublesome, etc. And, you know, I was listening to your talk just before you brought me on, and there is this sense that one of the things we're pathologizing now is any sort of rebellion against authority. So, you know, the kid who thinks his parents are not the smartest people during some period of his life, or thinks maybe people in authority, you know, wants to rebel against people in authority, or even, you know, school figures. Well, rebellion itself is being pathologized, you know, oppositional defiant disorder. Well, think about that. That just means you're not in tune with the powers that be. And if you extend that, that means that you could have any sort of rebellion against authority figures, even as adults, is seen as a pathological behavior. You go to work, you don't like your boss, that sort of thing. So DSM-5, I mean, listen, the real problem goes back to DSM-3, but DSM-5 is so absurd, it's really something for the Onion to satirize. The problem is, of course, that it affects our society in profound ways. It affects how kids grow up. Kids are getting medicated left and right. It affects how we conceive of ourselves, and it helps us think of ourselves as victims, of being not very resilient human beings, and that if we suffer some mood problem, often in response to an environmental, you know, setback, we think, oh, we must be ill. It's just a disaster for a country to start defining more and more behaviors as mentally ill and, you know, et cetera. And it's really frightening, I'd say, the possibility, the amount of harm that will be done by DSM-5 if, in fact, it comes into existence, is embraced by insurance companies. And that's the key. If insurance companies embrace for it, they'll use it.
Well, Robert, you have written what quite simply is the most important book on this topic. The depth of your scholarship, you've gone back, read the articles, you've gone back decades. I commend you for this. You certainly have given us an insight that we need. You've answered all three of the questions, and two more I was going to ask you. I thank you very much. All the best with this, and let's hope that this message begins to get out, that we're not all crazy and we don't all need these drugs. Okay? Thank you very much, sir. Robert Whitaker, author of Anatomy of an Epidemic. I'm Gary Knoll, and in studio is Elizabeth and also Jason. Hi, Jason.
Hi, good afternoon, Gary. Very quickly, before I have a question I got, I would like to ask for some volunteers. On Monday, we needed someone with an SUV or truck to drive out to Long Island with one of our coworkers.
Good.
And then secondly, we also need people next week to come in and volunteer to help us package.
Let me explain what we're doing.
Sure.
We're going to be doing a major social movement worldwide. It will really launch on September 21st at the Ethical Culture Center, when we're bringing in Professor Vandana Shiva and Helen Colicott, all these great people, to talk about why we should be closing down our nuclear facilities. We will be coordinating this all over the world. We'll be having people on the screen from multiple countries. But prior to that, and what we want to do immediately is take my new film, Knocking on the Devil's Door, and supporting articles, and send it out to thousands of different environmental groups, all state legislators, members of all of the media, so they're made aware of this. So we're going to need people to help us in just mailing all this out. And if they could call you, that would be very appreciative.
So my number is 646-926-5428. We'd appreciate the help.
And I don't want anyone doing anything else just yet. we have a massive campaign slated. Massive. I won't go into it because I don't want to tip our hand to the nuclear industry, who have a lot of funds and a lot of people on their side to fight back, and they will be. They're already engaging in dirty tricks. But we're going to make this happen.
If you don't mind, I'd like to read one question I got from Charlene in Mexico City. Charlene has been living in Mexico City for 4 years. She mm-hmm. was a social worker in Harlem for 18 years. Charlene left her job and moved with her partner to Mexico City. She listens to Progressive Radio Network every day, and it never occurred to her that the core listeners of BAI and the core listeners of PRN are so diametrically different. One has a future and one doesn't. She wanted to know, how do you approach a problem before getting eaten alive by this problem?
I think she's wrong. I think that that's an exaggeration. What I would suggest is that only by pulling away from an institution or work or belief can you see the value of it or its limitations. I believe that what we're seeing today is that many people who only went to certain media, whether it was BAI or NYE or Fox, that's their reality. They align themselves with that. What the problem is what if the solutions that are needed can't be found within that? What if the people are not the ones who have the solutions but could be very good and very well informed and very accurate on defining the problem? Defining the problem in and of itself is only half the issue. How do you solve it is the issue. And you must be very proactive and very positive. You can't be negative. You have to have, and you can't approach these, I believe, politically. I think one of the mistakes we've made in our society is viewing all problems as political, instead of saying, like, for example, on how we're approaching the whole close down the nuclear, it's non-political. Now, you think it is. It is not. I'm doing it as a health, universal health issue and a social issue behind it. I believe that we must start to work cooperatively with each other. This whole idea of watching Rachel Maddow, it's the Republicans and the immaturity and the sophomoric behavior of Keith Olbermann bashing Michelle Obama and all the ones on the right bashing everyone on the left. That gets us nowhere, and it doesn't define. Do any of these people, have they, any of them, solve the problem of home foreclosures? By the way, I just came up with a new statistic today. I wasn't aware of this. And this is a more accurate figure. 10.2 million American homes have been foreclosed on. Average of four people per home. That's 40 million. I was working on 20 million, five. I was working on half that figure. Now another 10 million homes are going to be closed on. That's another 40 million. That means we could have 80 million Americans homeless. But because most of those people are living in other people's homes, we don't see them. So the question is, what on the left and what on the right, what in any of these programs are dealing with that? How about none? How about the hungry people in America? None. How about the disease that's being produced by the very consumer-based society we live in? Do you think that everyone on the left is immune from eating junk food or smoking or doing things that are self-destructive? No, they're not. So the idea that you have one piece of a puzzle correct, have the humility to pull back and see what other people pieces you need. And what if you need a piece from people who are in the Green Party or the Tea Party or the Constitutional Party or some other belief system or the vegans or the environmentalists? Shouldn't you come together and shouldn't you look for the truth wherever it is without having to bring the ideology that truth originally was a part of? The trouble is we are not allowing ourselves to have any truth except one truth, and that's the truth of what we've defined. And hence, if you look at it from this way, is BAI and are the people listening to BAI, are they a part of the future? That depends upon them. Now, if this woman says, gee whiz, I didn't realize just how radical the perception was and the approach, and we need something that is more spiritual, more coming from the heart, I could understand her statement. But I believe it is imprudent and incorrect to dismiss everyone who listens to a station or the station itself as being irrelevant. BAI and its listeners will be relevant to the future as they once were in the past when they become more open, conciliatory, and humane in how they see issues and not exclude people. Why are we the number one listened to radio program and radio station in the world in progressive movements? Because no one's excluded. Everyone's included. and as a result is showing respect for life and respect for religions and respect for people, then suddenly you're not saying, oh, you're a Catholic, and you're an idiot. No, that's wrong, and that's been the extreme reactions of people who are ideologues. Or on the right, saying, oh, you're a person that doesn't believe the way, well, you're not a true believer, then we exclude you. The exclusion breeds contempt. Inclusion allows a synergy and symbiosis of healing. We need healing in order to progress further than what we have done up to this point, and Progressive Radio Network has a whole lot of open-minded, non-judgmental, progressive thinking people looking for solutions that do not exclude people, and that's why we have 93 million people who go to Progressive Radio for information, and all conservative and all liberal radio together don't equal that. So they're not willing to understand that. They can't wrap their minds around this. Mm-hmm. And so they stay focused on their one little piece of the puzzle, their one little truth, and realize that's not going to change anything. And they stay frustrated and angry and project that anger out unfairly. No, you have to come from the heart if you want to share new insights that would allow us to heal. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
We'll get to Elizabeth tomorrow, Elizabeth. And all of you, thank you very much for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Now stay tuned for a person who comes from the heart, but really impacts your mind. Mike Fader, here on Progressive Radio Network.
Producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.